Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
There's an image that comes out in 12 Step sometimes where you're sitting in the back seat and someone's driving the car erratically. And what you're doing is rolling the window up and down. This is back when, you had the hand crank for the window. You're rolling the window up and down, trying to control the car. And that becomes kind of a metaphor for the rest of your life, where you feel sort of out of control and you're constantly grabbing for these things that will give you the illusion of control, but they don't actually give you any control because you're looking, again, I think as you aptly point, you're looking outside of yourself. You're looking for someone to kind of give you the right system, give you the right method, give you the right sense of authority, the right air of mysticism or whatever it is. And then if I do it the right way, then I will feel right, then things will be okay. And the irony is that some of these things work.
This week on the podcast, we're airing a special 4-part series on the cult of personal development. So many of us pick up books and go to seminars in the hopes of improving our lives. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But it can be when we're not aware of how it can actually lead to a lot of bad things when we let charismatic leaders take advantage of us and manipulate us. So we decided to bring in former cult members to dissect this process and explain how this actually happens so that you can avoid it. So one thing I've realized after so many years of hosting this show is that you hear my voice every week, but I don't hear yours. And I'd really like to hear from you. For this episode, I'm excited to start something totally new called an airspace. An airspace is an audio group chat hosted by me and Bob, where you can send us an audio message. And when we reply, it'll show up in the main thread. I'll be using airspace for the next few days to talk more with Bob about toxic charisma and also answer your questions about this episode on charismatic leaders who are toxic. Click on the first link in the description to send me your questions now and view the conversation so far. And when we answer, you'll actually get an email letting you know. You can also be part of the airspace by going to unmistakablecreative.com/participate. Bob, welcome back to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure to be here. I love talking to you.
Well, likewise, and you are one of those rare guests who now can claim that you've been on the Unmistakable Creative 3 times, because we've had you and Alex together. And this time I wanted to bring you back as part of this series that I'm doing on the cult of personal development, to talk about the sort of darker sides of personal development that I think nobody wants to acknowledge. And obviously, you know, before we get into all that, you know, I like to start with questions that seem like they have nothing to do with your work. But actually, this time, I think this is actually quite relevant. That is, what religious or spiritual beliefs were you raised with? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you've made throughout your life and your career?
Oh, fascinating. So I was raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia in the Presbyterian Church. We weren't super serious, but we were, you know, pretty much every Sunday we'd go and then, you know, have milkshakes and grilled cheese sandwiches afterwards. And I like to think of it as, because of where we were in a very upper middle class suburb of Philadelphia. And if you're familiar with like the prosperity gospel, this idea that the more righteous you are, the better you do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't explicit at all in the church I was raised in, but there was very much a judgment, right? It was very culturally like, we are good Americans. We don't talk about sex. We don't experiment with drugs except for lots of alcohol. And I guess I was raised like thinking about seeing a lot of hypocrisy around me and pious on Sunday, and then people talking, you know, smack about each other behind each other's back, or people, you know, screwing people over in business and these kinds of things. And I really, I was kind of part of the church enthusiastically for a little while, because I've always been something of a spirit, had an interest in a spiritual life. Mm-hmm. But I left it, you know, pretty quickly. I feel like almost like most of my life has been a reaction against the church that I was raised in.
Yeah. Yeah. Something I wonder is sort of when in your life you started to really look at this through the lens of spirituality, because, you know, I've said before that, you know, if somebody had even told me half the things I talk about with my guests on Unmistakable Creative when I was at Berkeley in my 20s, I'm like, this all sounds like a bunch of New Age bullshit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's the work that I literally do today. So, you know, how old were you when you started to sort of have these questions about life and spirituality?
Oh, I think I was really young. I mean, I think I've always had a kind of a esoteric or spiritual yearning, or the sense that, you know, wanting to engage with the unseen world, or really in some ways also looking for instruction, you know, like what makes a good life? How can I be a good person? I think it was, you know, maybe that's my WASPy upbringing, but I had a great deal of shame. Mm-hmm. And I think I was always looking for the system. So while I reacted against the system that I was raised in, I think I was always looking for a new system. So very early on, in freshman year of college, I was actually a religion major, because they didn't have a philosophy class at the small liberal arts school I was going to. So I did, you know, classes in Old Testament and New Testament, and then some comparative religion, and found William James fairly early on, and, you know, the varieties of religious experience. Nice. I was also a huge fan of a poet named Gary Snyder, who was a friend of Jack Kerouac's and Allen Ginsberg's. And he had studied Zen in Japan. And so, you know, this was the late 80s. This kind of yoga wasn't really a thing yet. I guess it was. I mean, I was studying yoga even in high school, and also doing Tai Chi in high school. But I think a lot of it was I was trying to make myself exotic as much as I was trying to figure out anything else. You know, like in some ways it was just sort of a way to look cool to girls that I wanted to talk to, right? You know, and so I got really attached to, like, I read Jack Kerouac and the Dharma Bombs, as a lot of guys do in their you know, late teens, early 20s, and I got really obsessed with this guy Gary Snyder, who had gone to Japan to study Zen, and I eventually did that myself. I actually sat in the same temple that he did in Kyoto I sat there for about a year, and then also studied martial arts and. In Kyoto. And then I got very distracted by other things in Kyoto. So I'd say that, you know, my spiritual path has been sort of varied and never committed fully to a single path, except for very, very brief periods. Like I'm very, very much a dilettante, but it started early on. I even considered going, I know you live in Boulder. I visited the Naropa Institute and considered transferring to go to college there, and ended up having a conversation with a guy there that totally freaked me out. And and I was like, this place is not for me.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Yeah. He talked about how his heart was being ripped out every day. And I was like, I don't know that I want to have my heart ripped out every day. So,
yeah.
So I moved on. I also spent a lot of time in nature. So I did graduate from a school in Arizona called Prescott College, which was very, very oriented towards wilderness studies and the outdoors. And I think that was very much where I truly connected to spirituality, was in the outdoors rather than through, you know, these various sort of structures that I experimented with and dabbled in, you know, Zen and various forms of Tibetan Buddhism and martial arts.
Yeah. So the two things that come from this for me, you know, one, it's kind of an odd paradox, don't you think, that, like, you spend all this time seeking answers, you know, outward, and almost all of our sort of spiritual texts, you know, encourage us to turn inwards. One, why do you think that is? And then two, I'm curious about the contrast that you saw between sort of religion in a place like Japan versus religion here in the United States, because the thing that always comes to my mind is this stupid Indian superstition of not getting our haircuts on Tuesdays. And it's the most ridiculous thing, because nobody seems to know why the hell that's the case. And I thought, okay, I'm at an ashram in India. Let me ask these guys. They're like, barbershops are closed in India on Tuesdays. And I'm like, wait a minute, my parents have lived in the United States for 25 years and we still don't get our haircuts on Tuesdays. And the answers on Quora were ridiculous, from barbers need a day off to, you know, they need a day to sharpen their blades after cutting all that hair. But what I really wonder is, you know, what is it that causes people to turn outward rather than inward first, and then also the contrast between Japan and here.
Yeah. Well, I can't really speak, you know, for others, obviously, but I think for myself, again, I was looking to be fixed. And so I think I was looking for an authority figure, frankly, someone who would tell me the right set of rules. And so, you know, I grew up in a very, let's call it a very rule focused household. There wasn't a lot of, you know, warm, fuzzy feelings growing up, a little bit of, you know, a fair bit of trauma and drama that I grew up around. And if, you know, for your listeners, people who have grown up in environments where there is some, let's call it mental illness and addiction, which is definitely going on a lot in my family, that we end up, there's an image that comes out of in 12 step sometimes, where you're sitting in the back seat and someone's driving the car erratically. And what you're doing is rolling the window up and down. This is back when, you know, you had the hand crank for the window. You're rolling the window up and down, trying to control the car. And that becomes kind of a metaphor for the rest of your life, where you feel sort of out of control, but you're constantly grabbing for these things that will give you the illusion of control, but they don't actually give you any control, because you're looking, again, I think as you aptly point, you're looking outside of yourself. You're looking for someone to kind of give you the right system, give you the right method, give you the right sense of authority, the right air of mysticism or whatever it is. And then if I do it the right way, then I will feel right. And then things will be okay. And the irony is that some of these things work, right? Like somebody says, sit and meditate for a little while, and you sit and meditate for a little while. And that does force you to actually learn how to self-soothe, you know, sort of emotional imbalance, which has been one of my problems in life, where my emotions have swung very, very, you know, wildly and felt, I've kind of felt out of control of them. And meditation actually has given me a modicum of control. But at the same time, then you become overly dependent on it.
Yeah.
I'm really reminded of, if you're familiar with the cargo cults of the Pacific Islands. Do you know this metaphor?
I don't, actually.
So during the Second World War, these Pacific Islands became these stop-off points for all of, you know, both Axis powers as well as the U.S. powers. And all of this cargo started to arrive into these islands. Now, cargo is actually now a synonym for wealth in like Papua New Guinea. Like if you say, how much cargo do you have? You mean how much money do you have or how much wealth do you have? But what happened is after the war, the cargo dried up, obviously, because the islands were no longer really strategically important. And so planes didn't stop there anymore. But what happened is the islanders started to build like bamboo models of planes, life-size models of planes, as a kind of religion. So the idea is they got the form right, you know, here's the plane, like they connected prosperity to the plane, but they really didn't, they really didn't understand like the mechanism that it was actual planes coming and dropping this stuff off. And so I've heard the same critique in some ways around like say Buddhism in Japan, that the Japanese got the letter, but they didn't open it. So they have all the forms of that sit around. You know, this is not my critique necessarily. This is sort of a gross overgeneralization, but that they missed some of the heart of it. So when I went to Japan, one of the things I noticed was I had this idea that all Buddhists were vegetarian. They're not. because I was a vegetarian. I was like very righteous, you know, like I'm going to be a vegetarian. I remember sitting with a Zen priest at a restaurant. And he took me to his like favorite restaurant that served pork cutlet. And I said I was a vegetarian. And he looked at me like just shocked. He's like, wait, what? You're a vegetarian. And I was like, wait, what? Yeah. You're a Buddhist. So I think a lot of it was, this is a very, very long-winded way of saying that, that I think there's this distinction between what the shape of something is and what you really can get out of it. And I think that exists in sort of all religious traditions, right? So many religious traditions are really just about the form of it or the following the letter of the law rather than really engaging with the sort of the spiritual or the personal development or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Wow.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah, I think you brought up a word that really struck me, and that was this idea of dependency. And I think it's so ironic, and, you know, I've been mentioning this before, Werner Erhard, you know, the Landmark Forum, he told Dan Kennedy once, he said, you know, when Dan Kennedy said, sum it up for me in one sentence, he said, we sell independence, but we breed dependence. Mm. And I've noticed that. I've noticed how people sort of become personal development junkies, and rather than, you know, self-improvement improving their life, it becomes their life. And nothing actually changes as a result. What do you think, based on your own experience, causes that sort of dependency trap?
It's a really good question. Again, speaking for myself, you know, I'm going to go back to emotional maturity and emotional immaturity. This is a lens through which I've been looking at myself a lot recently. And one of the things I've noticed is that the times when I've been most dependent is when I've been looking outside of myself to kind of fix something inside of myself, which I think that's a, you know, a really interesting dichotomy you've brought up here. But, you know, I mean, it can be really straightforward in a relationship. I feel bad, and then I go to my partner and I'm like, make me feel good, you know, like, and, you know, the most, let's call it the most abusive I've ever been in a relationship is when my partner has like pulled that, you know, she stops looking at me in that way that makes me feel so, you know, soothed for a moment. And then I start berating her. It really makes no freaking sense, right? But I start berating her in a way to give that to me again, right? Like, and the typical is like, if she criticizes me in some way, I get defensive. You know, this is like going back to John Gottman's work, right? The yeah. defensiveness is sort of the one of the core things that destroys relationships. But that I'll get defensive because what I want is I want to feel good. And what I've lacked most of my life, or much of my life, is an ability to do what psychologists would call self-soothe, right? So when I feel upset, to then feel that feeling, be fully mm-hmm. present with that feeling, allow myself to really have it, process it, maybe even do a deep dive and go underneath it and say, well, what are the root causes of this, both sort of developmentally for myself or situationally for where I am right now? What can I do about it? What can I not do about it? Yeah. Do I just need to accept it? And, you know, again, I was raised in a family where there wasn't a lot of warm emotions. And certainly when I was emotional, there was a lot of disapproval. And so I learned to really distance myself from even my own awareness of how I felt about something. And so when I've become dependent, you know, as we're going to get to, I think, in this conversation, where I was in a cult for 2 years, and I was very dependent upon the community and very dependent upon the teacher, what I was dependent upon was approval, right? I needed somebody to tell me that I was a good boy, that I was doing okay, that I was doing a good job. And I think, at least for me, that's where this, you know, I'm looking for maybe a father figure, a mother figure, you know, to tell me that I'm okay, and that if I do something that they tell me to do, then I will be okay. And I think that's really the cult hit right there, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh yeah, you're right, you're not okay, but yeah. If you go and sell these courses for me, if you go and clean the center really well, if you, you know, do, you know, this spiritual practice, you know, this many times or something like that, then you will be okay. And you get kind of caught in this, you know, sort of endless hedonic loop, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so fascinating that, you know, you mentioned sort of authority figures, because even when I think about the seduction community and my experience with it, I realize people go there in a desire to improve themselves with women and dating. And what was hilarious, you know, kind of sad even, was how much time people spent seeking validation from other men, authority yeah. figures in the community. So this is kind of a real odd paradox. You know, now it's become about impressing other guys, you know, with your conquest, as opposed to actually improving yourself and, you know, getting better at dating and relationships.
Yeah. But, you know, we're also like tribal in, you know, and even, you know, the primate part of us, you know, looks for the powerful, you know, person in the environment and wants to curry favor in some way, like being attracted to the person who is most powerful in the environment. I do think it's somewhat natural. I don't know if it's healthy or unhealthy. I've seen, and I think we'll talk about this as well, like, what is it that makes a leader a positive influence versus a negative influence? Because I think we've just seen so many examples in the last few years of leaders, you know, whether it's, you know, a predator like Harvey Weinstein, who led an industry in a certain way, right? And who was mm-hmm. enabled by all sorts of, you know, really nefarious characters around him. Or whether it's Adam Newman at WeWork, who's, you know, whipping people up and getting people to work for below market wages in order to change the world through renting office space, right? You know, like, it's this kind of... I do think, you know, like, I follow certain people, like, there are certain people that really inspire me, that I want to be around, that I want to be with, and I want them to like me, obviously, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think there's something to that. But at the same time, there's a really, 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 you know, that can really hook into whatever maybe historical dysfunction we have.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue into talking about your own experience. And, you know, I mean, you sent me an essay that you wrote, which was just mind blowing about toxic charisma, which I realized was just such a perfect frame for our conversation. But for, you know, people who may not have heard your last interview, can you give us the sort of, you know, condensed version of how in the world you ended up in a cult?
Yeah, sure. That's a really great question. You know, there's always like the, you know, how did you get in and how did you get out, I think are the really, the really, really two interesting questions. And what's fascinating is that if you go and dig into the cult research, you would think that there would be some kind of personality type that would be attracted to cults. And there's, what the literature tends to show is that basically everybody is potentially a cult member at some time in their life. And a lot of it has to do with situational, you know, where you are situationally. Yeah. So cults tend to attract people when they are in moments of disruption in their life. So for me, I was, you know, I was actually fairly mature. I was fairly old. Like I was in my late 30s, early 40s, and was finishing with graduate school, also going through a divorce, which was not my first divorce. And having, I think, that moment that maybe a lot of people can have who haven't achieved what they want to achieve, you know, by middle age, where they're like, okay, I think it's me. I think I'm the common denominator here. And I think I need to change something. I think I need to try something new. And so I was both emotionally unstable. I really wanted approval of women, especially, right? Because I was going through this divorce and I'd been very unhappy in love throughout my life. Been serially happy and serially unhappy. I'd had this was my third marriage. So I'd had some really intense relationships, lots of, you know, merging my centering my life around somebody and then slowly watching that turn to hell. And I'd done that a few times and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Clearly, I need to try something new. Clearly, I need to try something different. And so I just went to a workshop on, you know, communication and at a place called One Taste in San Francisco. Actually, the first thing I did there, they had a blues dancing workshop. It was a couple's blues dancing workshop. But I went there and there were all these women who were attractive and they were vibrant and they seemed to really like me, you know, like they would, it was like very, very quickly, they were like, oh, you're so special, you know? And I wasn't in a state where my bullshit detector was going off or not, you know, was not going off or they were overriding it in some way. It's funny to say this, but you know, actually one of those women is still a very close friend of mine. We both left the cult later on. Yeah. It was this very, very attractive. It was a place that made me feel welcomed, made me feel loved, made me feel cared for. It's what they call love bombing. It's all over the cult literature. Very, very classic. And I was at a place of transition in my life. So I was also finishing graduate school, leaving my wife, and therefore also sort of homeless, looking for a job, looking for the next thing to do, and feeling this sense of, I want to do something that matters. I want to do something that makes a difference in the world. You know, part of it was, I think, altruistic and good. And part of it was maybe, you know, a little bit of egoistical or egotistical, right? Like I want to feel like a good person. So a good person, you know, it's that Silicon Valley BS, right? You know, like we're changing the world through non-interlaced video compression or something like that. You know, like everything is about changing the world, even when it doesn't relate to changing the world. And I was very much caught up in that, you know, aughts, the hubris of the era. And we were very connected to Silicon Valley in a lot of ways too. There were a lot of engineers that came through the place. We were actually funded by a fairly wealthy investor and inventor. Who I also kind of became somewhat close to. So it was a very interesting time and very attractive, and it delivered on its promises in some ways. You know, like all of a sudden there was more sex in my life. There was more attention in my life. There were more hugs in my life. There was more sense of purpose in my life. And for a while it was very, very, very attractive and very, well, seductive.
Yeah. I mean, as a single guy, I can't think that I wouldn't enjoy that either. Like, I appreciate the fact that you brought up, you know, the idea that your bullshit detector, you know, wasn't you know, on at that point. And I think that would be particularly hard for any guy. Like if you're, you know, in a vulnerable state and you're getting all this attention from attractive women, I think I would be very unlikely to be able to turn on a bullshit detector as well. I'd be like, ah, this is fantastic. So I guess the question then is, you know, why do people's bullshit detectors not go off, or why didn't yours, outside of the fact that you're in, you know, sort of this emotionally vulnerable state?
Well, I think there's a few things, you know, in the essay that I wrote that you referenced, which, by the way, I'm still looking for a place to publish. So if you have an idea, I cite the work of a neuroscientist by the name of Antonio Damasio, who wrote a book called Descartes' Error. And Damasio is kind of a legend in the field, but one of the things he really looks at is the roles that emotions play in decision making. And what was really fascinating to me is that a lot of the patients or a lot of the cases that he worked with are people who have had brain damage in a certain way that makes it almost impossible for them to have an emotion. So they become purely analytical. And you would think that that would lead to better decision making. But what he found is that people who have that tend to get, there's way too much data available to make most decisions, and a lot of it is inconclusive. So one of the stories he tells is somebody trying to decide where to go for dinner. And he literally just spends hours trying to decide where to go for dinner because there's way too much, you know, like where, what proximity, health, what is it? What does it taste like? What does it cost? You know, all of these different factors. And he just sort of can't say, well, what do I like? What do I want? And so what Damasio says is that, that emotions actually constrain the value of emotions is that they constrain the field within which our logical mind will operate. And there's a cult researcher, a cult survivor and therapist and researcher named Janja Lalich, who wrote a wonderful book called Take Back Your Life. And she articulated this thing she calls it bounded choice. So the idea is that you have all of your logical faculties are available to you, but they are bounded via emotional attachment to a leader or to a community inside of a sort of nonsensical potentially, right? Like, so for me, what happened was I became very attached to the group. The group was where they became my friends. They became my lovers. They became my job. They became where I lived, you know, like, so everything I did became wrapped up in this group. And so I could spend all day, every day thinking about, you know, using pretty good logical faculties. I'm a pretty logical guy. And fairly intelligent, at least by standard, you know, definitions, I guess. But all of that intelligence and all of that logic was used inside of this bound that said, this organization is the most important organization on the planet. So I couldn't see outside of that boundary. And so all of my activity became, you know, like I couldn't see, it's like not being able to see outside the maze or the labyrinth, right? Like you can spend all of your intelligence and energy inside of the labyrinth, but you can't ever see the walls that you're operating inside of. And that was, you know, sort of the life I lived for 2 years.
Wow. So, you know, I think that the thing that struck me most when I read this article was the fact that, you know, last time when we spoke, you were very deliberate about not bringing up the name of the organization. This time you even called out the leader of the organization. You didn't even, you know, you didn't hold back about this. And what prompted that change? Like why now? And why did you come out?
Well, there are two things. First off, I sent you an unpublished version of the article. The article still hasn't been published yet. And I debate, you know, honestly, there are, as I understand it, there's some open legal cases against the organization and against the leader right now. Mm-hmm. There are things that I don't, you know, I certainly, you know, don't want to get involved in, right? I don't want to be implicated or anything like that.
Right.
But at the same time, I think I really do, I don't think anything good happens in the world without some degree of risk and boldness. And I think right now, the other piece is just even talking about the cult. When I first started talking about it, I talked about it under a pseudonym. So there's all sorts of layers of anonymity or, you know, me talking about it without naming it. That was kind of one step. Step before that was me talking about it without naming myself. Recently I was on another podcast where I was not named, but the organization was named, right? But it was still my voice, right? And so all these layers. And so now you know, you get the scoop, right? This is you're the first time where my name and the name of the organization are really being attached to each other in a public way. And I can't say, you know, like I've sat down with, you know, frankly, my lawyer would tell me not to do any, you know, not to say anything, because he always says, you know what lawyers say. Lawyers say no.
Like lawyers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They just say remove all risk, you know, unplug your computer from the internet, and then you'll avoid viruses, right? But I do think there's real value in talking about the specific dynamics that I experienced inside this organization. And also, you know, frankly, when I watch the courage with which people like Leah Remini, talking about Scientology, or Sarah and Nippy and Mark Vicente and all of them talking about Nexium, which, by the way, our group and Nexium, I think, shared some very, very, very common DNA.
Wow.
And then I think there's also the other side of it, where there's a dynamic inside when people leave cults. We all do it in sort of different ways. There's a very common, actually, we talked, I think, before we turned on the record about Matthew Remsky's work over at Conspirituality. Mm-hmm. But one of the things he talks about is I got mine-ism. And the I got mine-ism is, well, the organization was pretty good for me. I don't know what happened to those other people, but, you know, I got something out of it. Yeah. And I understand that. I actually got a lot out of my involvement with One Taste. You know, some of their techniques or technologies or practices I found very valuable. And in some ways, I also got to explore some things in life that I probably wouldn't have gotten to otherwise, being the kind of nervous and uptight dude that I was. It also got me to hit a kind of crazy bottom, which allowed me to unpack my life and put it back together in a much, much more productive way. So they didn't intend to do that, but I got that out of it, because, you know, leaving and being and recovering was such a valuable experience for me as well. Mm. But I do think it's important to really talk about what we're talking about. I don't want to talk in code anymore. And I'm fortunate enough to be successful enough in my career that, you know, I can take more gambles than maybe I could have a few years ago when I was, you know, kind of broke and putting my life back together.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that you say in the essay is that to lead a happy and productive life, we must learn how to recognize when charisma is being used maliciously and how we can avoid being taken in by it. If we don't understand toxic charisma, we open ourselves up to heartbreak, loss, and exploitation. And yet, you know, on the surface, what looks like toxic charisma is incredibly charismatic, you know, like to your point, you know, how does Elizabeth Holmes, you know, end up getting that many people to believe in something that's a total fraud? How does Adam Neumann walk away with $1 billion, you know, relatively unscathed while all these other people got screwed? And so I wonder, you know, first off, like how do we overlook this? Like what happens? Because, you know, when I think about this, I kind of wonder if some of the sort of, you know, top personal development people in the world fall into this category of toxically charismatic.
100%. Yeah. And one of the questions I'm going to get your question in a sec, one of the things you bring up for me is, did they start off charismatic?
Yeah.
Did they start off toxic? Right. Mm. Or did they learn how to, because this is something I think I always wonder when I see somebody doing something that I think is kind of a grift, right? Which I think is so common right now among internet influencers and even in personal development world, right? Mm-hmm. Where people sell really expensive programs or they sell supplements based on how attractive they are or how funny they are, you know, like, one person I go into in the article and who's really top of mind for me right now is JP Sears, right?
That stood out to me for sure.
Yeah. And I thought he was funny as hell when I first saw him, you know, like he's sort of self-deprecating and, you know, his How to Be Ultra Spiritual. I loved it. I thought it was so fun and so funny. And I didn't necessarily really follow his work, but then now I find, you know, here it is a few years later, and over the course of the last year, I've become very aware of him, and I've followed his stuff a lot more closely and a lot of the critique of it. He's anti-mask, anti-vax. He's, you know, on one podcast with he was talking about threatening violence to public health workers who are going to vaccinated in his community, you know, just in this offhand kind of like silly kind of way. And then he's like, it's just jokes, right? So he's attracted a bunch of people, and he slowly, I think, turned toxic. I think in the beginning he wasn't, at least because it was sort of like he was making fun of himself and a community he was part of, and now he's making fun of other people. And it's this like really sort of gross, cutting, weird stuff that I find, maybe I don't have a sense of humor, but I just don't find funny. But the thing is, the dude monetizes his stuff by selling supplements and selling life coaching courses. So the more attention he gets, the more money he makes.
Yeah.
And I think there's this dynamic when you're charismatic, that you, especially now in the age of the internet, right? You can monetize that stuff, right? You can, and monetization is you can not only monetize it, but you can get ego strokes from it as well. People telling you how funny you are, how great you are, how amazing you are, mm-hmm. buying your bullshit. And sometimes I think people start off saying, I'm going to say what I believe, and then I'm going to get some attention, and then I'm going to monetize that attention, and that's going to be a good thing. And then they start saying, I'm going to say what gets attention because I'm monetizing that attention. Right. And then they maybe even start to believe that thing that they're saying, right? You know, and I really don't know where that, you know, power corrupts, right? When people, when people get told, you know, like Adam Newman, you tell him you tell a 30-year-old he's Jesus Christ. Scott Galloway loves to say this, right? You tell a 30-year-old he's Jesus Christ, and he's going to believe you, right?
Yeah.
And so I really can't unpack that because I can't see inside people's heads. But what I can do, and what my intent was in the article, and people would love to talk about some here, is I can't talk about what makes somebody toxic, why they become toxic, but I can help you understand when you are in the thrall of somebody who is toxic to you and potentially what to do about it. And that's really what I'm interested in.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, the thing that I thought was fascinating, you say that demagogues speak to fears and prejudices because they know that it will make people feel cared for and they're easier to influence. Gaining trust without earning it is the essence of charisma. And this is something, you know, I writing this new book called Not Another Damn Self-Help Book, in which I'm actually questioning, you know, a lot of you know, sort of personal development and asking people to consider whatever advice they get in the context of their own lives, which is why, you know, even in my community, I almost every time I teach something, I give it with the caveat that you should consider the possibility that everything I'm telling you is bullshit, because it might be. Like, I can't claim that I'm the authority figure on this. Yeah, I have experience, but I feel like people often, what happens so often, and I see this, I've seen this with people who follow our own guests, where they treat guidance as gospel. And so, you know, one, you know, why is it that we have this whole idea of there's something missing? Like, that seems like the easiest thing to prey on. And these people really take advantage of that. And, you know, I see it, like you said, I mean, influencers do the same thing. And you actually say toxic charisma is essentially a confidence game, a con. A shady salesman may trick us out of money or might give up our lives for the ego of a charismatic leader or any number of shades in between. And like, I almost kind of feel like, you know, I could look back at people that I have met as a byproduct of doing this work and say, yeah, they fall into that category. Some of them might even be our own peers.
Yeah. 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 Sorry, what? Can you ask the question again?
Yeah, I guess it was more a comment than a question, really.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, like, how is it that we actually, you know, don't recognize this? And you know, the thing is that people are being exploited and yet nobody seems to acknowledge this. You know, like, one of the things I remember hearing was, you know, what a typical Tony Robbins seminar is like. Obviously, you know, lights down low, blaring music, room cold, like everything that basically will cause people's rational thinking to shut off. And somebody had told me a story where he gives this really emotional speech, and it turns out the whole thing is a sales pitch. And, you know, a friend told me another, you know, well-known leader in our space, you know, does something very similar and gets all these really charismatic people to get up on stage. And she said, literally, people walk to the back of the room, open their checkbooks and sign $10,000 checks.
Yeah.
And so often they're spending money they don't even have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've done it. I've gone to one of those landmark graduations and ended up putting money down. I never actually went to the landmark thing, but it was clearly a, you know, we're going to put you in a certain emotional state, and then we're going to ask you to make a rational decision about your finances, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's, I find it toxic, right? So in my article, I also reference Terry Cole. If you don't know her work, she's wonderful. Yes. Terry's great. So, and one of the things she says is like, look, here's some ways to kind of like figure out whether or not somebody is kind of pulling a game on you, right? One, you know, like, are they introducing, like, are they making you feel urgent, right? Mm-hmm. Like that, you know, buy now or you're going to missing out, you know, which is really, really common. I think that's the scenario that you're describing. Or
yeah,
are they saying that, you know, that there's a certain truth that you can only get here. It's the in out game. And at One Taste, man, we played that game all the time, right? Like, we were the cool people. You are not the cool people. Right. And you had all sorts of inside language that kind of reinforced it. And we did it very, very conscious. I mean, we did it extremely consciously. Like, we would even talk behind the scenes about who we were going to push out so they would come back in, right? So they would feel outside, and then they would kind of, you know, you talk about the pickup community. I've spent a little bit of time around it, right? The idea of negging, right? That you put somebody down so they will then seek your approval, right? Which is also another one of Terry's points, right? Do I feel compelled to seek the approval of this person? But I think there's all these like sort of markers. So I guess your question is like, how does this happen? It happens by design very, very often, I think. I think people, like, sales techniques are scare the hell out of you, right? And then inspire the hell out of you, and then do it in sort of, and then love bomb you, right? Like, Like, if you keep going this way, your life is going to be terrible. It's going to turn to shit, right? Yeah. We have a unique way to do that, but you have to act now. And then it's not one thing, but it's, and people do it in a variety of ways and with a variety, you know, when you're in the presence of someone who's doing it poorly, it's just so obvious. It's like, okay, what are you doing, buddy? I totally see through you, but it can happen. There are some people, like, this is something they say about Bernie Madoff. Like, Bernie Madoff, he actually was like, oh, I'm too full. I can't take on any more investors. And he also never promised like wild returns. He's like, no, I'm going to give you slightly better than market, but very steady returns over a very long time. And that was how he, you know, and he was very convincing, which is also what you hear people say every time you hear an interview about Adam Newman. Adam was very convincing, is this like phrase that comes up again and again. And it's these people who are just like, they exude a certain kind of authority. They exude a certain kind of compassion towards you and empathy towards you. It can be very performative. And they pull you in. And often it's very, there's a cold reading aspect to it too, right? Where you can sort of, they can look into you. Now, Nicole Dadone, the founder of One Taste, like, she was really good at this, where you could be in a whole room full of people and you would feel like she was talking directly to you, directly to your concerns, directly to into your heart, into your soul. Like, she was so good at it, and you felt seen, you felt loved, and you felt like, oh, I want to give her everything. I want to give her all of my time, all of my energy, my money, everything. And I saw her do this again and again and again.
Mm. Wow. So I think the realization I came to with the seduction community is that I pushed this sort of desire to improve to a point of diminishing returns, where we were looking at our lives and I'm like, we don't actually, you know, we're not attractive to women because all we're obsessed with is how to be more attractive to women. Like, have you guys realized how ridiculous this is? And, you know, when my friends and I started to finally sort of shake out, like, you know, it involved going to therapy to like undo all this damage. I mean, even when I worked with Nick Notice, who was a dating coach, he told me, he said, the hardest guys to coach are the ones who've been through the seduction community, because he said, I have to undo so much baggage and bullshit. And he himself had been through all of that. Yeah. So, like, what is it that, you know, gets people to that point of diminishing returns? And more importantly, like, why don't they recognize it when they've reached it?
Yeah. So as I understand, you know, sort of the underlying sort of cultic dynamic. So I've talked about love bombing, right? So love bombing gets you in and it makes you feel like, I'm part of this community. And, you know, I'm still thinking back on, there were moments that I had that are some of the most sort of spiritual and satisfying that I can still even access today, right? Thinking back on how I felt, how approved of I felt, how loved I felt, how loving I felt towards everybody around me. It was really in some way sort of a peak neurological experience. But then what happens is, you know, again, the sort of scarcity, right? We're talking about it with Bernie Madoff and others, right? Is that they will then sort of push you out. And so I think it's very akin to what drives sort of narcotics addiction, right? Is like, the first high is amazing and the subsequent highs just aren't as good. And you're always chasing that initial experience, that initial high. And you don't really notice that while you're chasing that high, that you're not, because your logical brain is then, you know, constrained and bounded by, you know, this emotional attachment you have to the group or to the leader, that you're not really noticing, well, wait a minute, I joined because I wanted to get this particular outcome. And like, am I going to benchmark again, you know? And certainly they don't encourage you to benchmark against that outcome, right?
Yeah.
And there's also an irony to it as well, because many of these groups say, I promise you freedom. I promise you freedom from want, freedom from your own mind, freedom from your own desires, you know, like the sort of classical spiritual, right. Come on. But the business model of the group is dependence, right?
Absolutely.
You
know? Yeah.
So they don't want you to leave, really. And so as soon, you know, and so actually it's funny. I just heard Nippy and Sarah from Nexium talking about this with Matthew Remsky, their podcast, but that they were saying like that as soon as you got some achievement, then your problem was now your attachment to that achievement, and you had to, you know, and so what was interesting for me is like when I went into One Taste, I went in because I was trying to, I guess, fix my relationships with women. You know, it was sold as a kind of communication course and, you know, sexual experience or, you know, skill or, you know, having some facility with both sexuality as well and communication. And it very quickly became a spiritual endeavor, which is not what I went to it for. I didn't go to it because I wanted to become enlightened, but all of a sudden they're talking about being enlightened. And I understand like after I left that they were even like, they had like priests, you know, and priestesses, you know, the, like the religious language became really, really overt, which it wasn't when I was there. But yeah, I think it's like that, you know, you just keep moving the goalposts and keep selling somebody something else. Right.
Yeah. Well, I love that you brought up that they don't, you know, benchmark against the original goal you came in with, because, you know, you go in even to something like the seduction community, 90% of the guys there probably were there to find a girlfriend. And, you know, the benchmark then becomes, no, your problem is that you want a girlfriend and your solution is to sleep with as many women as possible. So that then, you know, changes the benchmark, which I just, you kind of realize that, wow, we just, you know, everything goes off the rails at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you create a need that can never be filled, right? The, you know, yeah.
So let's go back into this idea of influencers, because I think, you know, these are the people that we're most exposed to. I mean, hell, every single person who comes on the show would fall into this category of influencer. And, you know, I was writing about the fact that I think, you know, like I said, you know, a mother of three children who works three jobs to put food on the table is an influencer. Mother Teresa is an influencer. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't influence shit, you know. But I think that we've taken this whole influencer label so far that, you know, when people are like, I'm an influencer, I was like, what the fuck does that even mean? What do you influence? But you make this point to say that, you know, influencers turn charisma into currency by monetizing clicks, which can make it hard to determine who believes what they say and who believes that, you know, what they say will get them noticed. And there's so many people who are doing that. You know, I mean, this is one of my sort of ways to filter for podcast guests is to, like, you know, look through my bullshit detector first and say, is there any legitimacy to what this person is saying? You know, and so often what I've seen is people building massive brands, packaging their shit as science, even though it's pseudoscience because it's just based on a sample size of one, and, you know, building movements around it. I mean, I won't name any names. Some of them have even been guests on the show. And you realize, like, is there any legitimacy or credibility to what this person is saying?
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a tough one for me. Cause you know, I'm friends with people and sometimes I like dig into their stuff and I'm like, oh, I don't know whether I'm becoming much more, I think also less black and white in my thinking, you know, where I can, you know, and a lot of what I try to do is to read from a lot of different sources, because I think people can be extremely convincing, and they can be extremely convincing based on very shoddy data sets. And I think some of those data, sometimes that's because people are using, you know, themselves as their only, you know, as the only data. Hey, it worked for me, it'll work for you, right? That's a really common, come on. And then sometimes you get people. I've been unpacking Sam Harris's work a lot recently, you know, like, cause I find myself, you know, sort of disagreeing with him, and I'm like, well, but he makes a lot of sense and he's clearly a smart guy. And then I went to this whole sort of deep dive on some of the data sets that he uses that are really, you know, like he's using retracted studies to make points that are, let's call it politically problematic at times. Right. Like, and I think sometimes there are people who really play very, either intentionally or unintentionally, play very fast and loose with data, or the data that they care about. Cause I think you get this, you know, you're in the podcast world, you're in the sort of influence world. And one of the things I really like about you is like, and I'm so honored to kind of have been on your podcast so many times, is I don't have that many followers. And that's sort of by design and sort of by laziness and sort of by lack of skill. And maybe even through distrust at times as well, because I think there is this, well, how many followers do you have? Okay, you have this many followers, so you can broadcast this to your list and this will grow my list by this percentage and I'm going to monetize this list in this way, right? And so what I've seen, you know, kind of, you know, and you know, my wife is also, you know, she was in the influencer world to a certain degree as well for a long time, that, you know, I've been at parties where people will say, how big is your list? And I'm like, what the hell? You know, like, and really what they're asking is, how seriously should I take you?
Yeah.
And so we've, social proof is valuable, right? You know, like some, you know, like we want to check our bullshit detector by saying, well, I think gossip has a real value. Like, does somebody walk their talk? Like, we want to know that at times, but I think in the age of social media, it's hacked our brains in so many ways. And one of the ways it's hacked us is that the more, you know, likes and subscribes you see on somebody's list, you're like, oh, well, you know, the more important that person is. It's like the more dollar, you know, I see on the price tag of a bottle of wine, the better I sort of somehow naturally think that bottle of wine is, unless I know a lot about wine or have spent a lot of time, you know, questioning that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, we openly say on our contact form, we don't give a shit how many followers you have. We could care how many books you've sold. And we've turned down, you know, really high profile people who everybody else says yes to. I pride myself on that. I think that you bring up an incredibly important point, which is context. You know, like my two most important mentors are practically invisible on the internet. One of them had 150 followers when I met him, which is why I think that one of our biggest mistakes we make when it comes to this is to judge somebody's credibility by how they present themselves online, because we know anybody can manufacture the appearance of authenticity and legitimacy nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe people are really good at, you know, I did my undergrad in philosophy and, you know, sort of cognitive biases and logical fallacies. It's kind of funny to speak as an ex-cult member to be like, I really care about logical fallacies and cognitive biases. But I do, I spend a lot of time thinking about those and sort of checking myself for those. And what I find is, and what's really interesting is, I think also intelligence can sometimes work against us, right? So one of the things that the data will tell us too is that the smarter people are, often the better they are at defending their own biases, right?
Yep.
And so true. Yeah. And so I see this. I feel like you see this a lot in the social media world. So for myself, you know, I left Twitter a little while ago. I left Facebook a little while ago. I'm still on Instagram, but you know, it's on probation right now. I stay on LinkedIn because it's definitely valuable for business for me. It is where, you know, people find me so I can do work for them. But I'm also very cautious about really engaging in anything that's meaningful in text-based communication, even, you know, like I find if I want to have a good conversation with somebody, I want to do it in one of two ways. Either I want to do it like we're doing it now, sort of voice to voice, or, you know, ideally when all this pandemic is over, face to face and really spending time with somebody in sort of a deep way. And then the other is to write about it. And so I've put myself on sort of a program where I'm writing a personal essay, a sort of meaty personal essay about once a quarter. It's about all I have time for given my other commitments, but really trying to challenge myself to write the hardest thing that I think I can, the thing that I think I understand the least, and really doing my best to both be very clear about what it is I believe, what it is I know, and why I know it, you know, really trying to understand the epistemology of what it is I'm saying. And then two, sharing it with people and saying, what do you see in this, right? Like, what am I missing? What does your life experience? And I try to, you know, have readers and friends and community who come from a variety of, you know, backgrounds. You know, I want people who wear different gender identities and different racial backgrounds and, you know, families of origin. And I'd like to have that sort of, I think having that richer feedback on how it is I'm showing up in the world, how what I'm saying, I think about, you know, semiotics a lot, right? Like that what, you know, that the context into which we say something is important. The context from which we say something is important. And the communication is what happens between the context into which we are speaking and the context from which we're speaking from. Yeah. And that we cannot see that by ourselves. And so that in many ways we are works in progress and we're co-created by our communities. And so having people in my life and having a community around me, not a cult around me, because the cult is all thinking the same thing and all looking for the same leader to the same leader to the same sort of mental framework, but really challenging my thinking as much as I can from as many different angles as I can. I think it keeps me honest. It keeps me happy. And hopefully at some point it'll result in an essay or two that's really valuable for the world. So.
Yeah. I think what you're really talking about here is self-awareness. I mean, this is why I try to bring on, you know, as many different perspectives as I can. You know, I will talk to people who are extremely religious because I want to learn, you know, how they see the world and what I can learn from them. You know, I've had people, like I've reached out to former white supremacists because I want to talk to them. I want to find out why they have thought this way. And I think that that's so important because we tend to consume so much content in an echo chamber. Like, I realized after a certain point, and I think I wrote about this the other day, it was like lifestyle design versus life by design, and how, you know, we got to early 2009, you know, Tim Ferriss's 4-hour work week becomes sort of, you know, mainstream in the zeitgeist. And suddenly the narrative is this is the way that you are supposed to live a really amazing and rewarding life. And we suddenly started to discount normal. You know, it's like, oh, you know, like we would see people who worked 9-to-5 jobs and, you know, lived relatively normal lives as beneath us. And I was like, who's to say those people aren't happier?
Yeah.
And who are we, you know, in our sort of entrepreneurial sort of high horse to say, oh, you know, the way I live is better. Like, I realized, like, that's absolute bullshit. I think this whole year for me has been really, the last year and a half has been really looking at my own work through context and saying, okay, consider everything that, you know, you hear from me or any guest or anybody for that matter in the context of your own life, because it might not be true.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you really, actually, Alex and I talk about this a lot. You know, this has been a hard year for a lot of people, us included. It's also been really rich in that it's given me time and space to do an awful lot of reflection, because I used to spend a lot of time in airplanes and traveling and running around to different things. And so with that removed, I developed a much more serious sort of introspection practice, the first in a little while. And then we've also had some real challenges, you know, mental health problems in our families and, you know, the fear of the pandemic and health problems and a variety. And, you know, I'm 55, I turn 56 fairly soon, which I always remind myself is like the age that Steve Jobs died at, you know, like, and what have you done with your life, you know?
Yeah.
And so this idea of like, well, what makes for a good life, or what makes a life meaningful and worthwhile? And the best I've come up with, is that I want to do my best to do really good work. I want to, you know, like, and my work is about writing. My work is also about, I do a lot of work with organizations and helping them with decision-making and team development and those kinds of things. And I'm doing my best to pick the organizations that I think are net positives for the world, and to pick topics that I think are topics that should be investigated. But I also don't get to, you know, there's a saying, it also comes out of 12-step, but I think it comes out of a sort of an older, you know, sort of Christian monastic tradition, which is like, you have a right to your labor, but what you don't have a right to is the fruits of the labor, right? Like, and I think we inverted that in the personal development, you know, bonanza that we went on, you know, starting in the mid 2000s, where everybody, it was all about lifestyle design, right? Which is all about the fruits of the labor, but not necessarily about what the labor was, what the quality was. As a matter of fact, many people were trying to, you know, retire early and retire often, right? You know, like get out of the rat race, be completely free, go to Burning Man all the time, have fun, take drugs, have sex. But, you know, I think where I've certainly participated in that world and had fun in that world, but where I'm coming back to more and more is that, like, it's really the quality of work and the quality of relationships is what makes for a meaningful and a good life for me. And I may never be famous. I may never have much of an impact except for the people right around me. And as long as I, you know, live until I die, I guess that's okay.
As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, I'm really excited about something totally new called an airspace that gives you an opportunity to participate in the show and ask your questions. All you have to do is submit a question, and either a guest or I reply, you'll get an email letting you know. And all you have to do is go to unmistakablecreative.com/participate. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/participate. I can't think of a better way to wrap up this conversation. So I have one final question for you, which I know I've asked you multiple times. What do you think it is to make somebody or something unmistakable?
Well, it could be recency bias because of what I was just talking about. But I think what I look for is when I think about the people in my life that would match that description, it's people who are unapologetically themselves and, you know, willing to be bold, be definitive, take risks, and then also have a kind of humility and curiosity that sits behind it. And I sometimes go back to like Otto Schwarmer's work around presence, right? This idea that like, I don't know exactly how to describe what presence is, but I know what it is when I feel it, when I'm in somebody's presence. So somebody who can be present with me either virtually or hopefully not virtually soon, right? That's what really makes the difference for me.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your perspective and your insight as a part of this series. I mean, I knew it was kind of a no-brainer to bring you back, and this has been really, really thought-provoking. Where can people find out more about you and your work and everything they're up to, given that we know you're not on social media anymore?
Sure thing. Well, I run a small little company along with my wife. We're called The Alignment Company, and we help leaders align their teams on all levels so they can maximize their performance. So alignmentco.com is where you can find all things Bob Gower these days. BobGower.com, it's still there, but it hasn't been updated in a while. So maybe go to Alignment Co.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator, that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.